Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Welcome back. We've got a lot to cover, and we don't have any time to get into it. What we've gotten, because I told you, we was hoping to have Loy Brunson, one of the Brunson brothers, who is arguing and has a case in front of the Supreme Court for review. So we're going to get into the details of this case and the details of, you know, where they are in the process and so forth. And then we're going to kind of meander into some constitutional conversing and some suppositions, some ideas, and so forth. And I think it's a very interesting dialogue. We will end up literally, I think, connecting again when they finally get the disposition on the conference that the Supreme Court will have regarding their case to find out whether it's moving forward into arguments and to be actually heard, or whether they basically pass or what have you. So it's important that we kind of understand what's going on, because there's a lot of different legal cases and so forth. And I think Loy will bring up this fact that there's another case that's currently active. He was unaware of the We the People Foundation one that we've worked on and supported. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter. I mean, we're in a crisis, and we need one of these cases to make it through the gauntlet to actually get the Supreme Court to prove to the American people whether they're going to maintain or become the guardians of the Constitution once again, or whether they are another entity that is still corrupt, that is still turning its back on the Constitution. Because doesn't, you know, we don't know what the outcome is going to be, even if they listen to this case. But I think the American people deserve to know where the Supreme Court is standing today, based on its construct of its members, whether they are guardians of the Constitution or not, because that's what they're supposed to be. And so just because they got the Roe v. Wade kind of right, as we've talked about that in detail, I think it's important that we actually look at the Electoral College, the process that happened in 2020, and the outcome and what needs to be done about it. So we're going to have this quick conversation. As a matter of fact, we're going to go out to break, and instead of doing anything else, because this is basically almost 50 minutes of a conversation back and forth between Loy and myself. And so, I'm talking to a guy that's like a brother of the Constitution. I love it when I get a chance to talk to people that have a really good understanding of the Constitution, to where we can actually, you know, start finding differences of what we really understand, because 98 to 99% of all the stuff we agree on. That all being said, I hope to create a long-term relationship with Loy and his brothers, and be able to, you know, work together in unifying people on the Constitution, because that's what it's all about. We have to actually focus on the Constitution, and very specifically the Constitution, not what other people want to make it out to be, like the federal government's annotated Constitution. But anyway, so we're going to go into break, and instead of actually going into, you know, a break with, you know, some sponsors or what have you, we'll be coming right back. As soon as the music ends, my conversation with him will begin, and then when the conversation is over, we're going to go straight into, without any music or anything else, we're going to go straight into a content advertisement. Actually, it's more of a promo. So we'll do the promo, and then we will end the show. So, because literally we didn't have any other time to be able to provide, you know, analysis or what have you. And in our next show, we're going to be covering, you know, Feedback Friday, because obviously Friday's tomorrow. And so what we want to do is go through the Feedback Friday and get right back into the strategic content of petitions of what we need to be doing across the board on all of the issues of the constitutional violations. We will be right back with Loy. Folks, we are here with Loy Brunson. And as a matter of fact, Loy, you've been doing this for quite a while. Just some real quick personal background on yourself. You are a constitutional lawyer. You're with the Utah Bar. or?
No, actually, there are three brothers that are doing this, and none of us are members of the bar. None of us are licensed attorneys.
Okay, great. That's fine. And so you're out of Utah then, and you actually, because the one thing that we did talk about, you pursued this in the Denver Circuit Court or the 10th Circuit Court.
Well, we actually started, we have two cases.
Okay.
One is at the Supreme Court, and the other one is in federal court. It's still alive.
Okay.
It's not been dismissed.
And which one is, what court is that? Is that in the 10th?
No, we started in the federal court of Utah. It's the Utah District, U.S. District Court.
Okay. Okay.
U.S. District Court, Utah District.
Okay, so let's first start with the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court case, which is the lawsuit with against Congress. And actually,
sure,
I think it's Biden and Kamala Harris as well.
Yeah, it's exactly the same case that is in federal court right now. We started with me as the plaintiff and battled the U.S. attorneys in federal court. And what happened was filed in federal court, I believe it was March 31st, 2021, the U.S. Marshals Service were ordered by the Federal Court of Utah to issue 388 summons and complaints. So on March 31st, about 80 of them were, according to the docket, Nancy Pelosi, Maxine Waters, Adam Schiff, and others were served my summons and complaint by the U.S. Marshals Service. The reason the U.S. Marshals Service was ordered by the court to do that is we couldn't get them served any other way because of the lockdown and the protection they had. So the court allowed, you know, the court ordered that to happen. But the next day, April 1st, 2021, excuse me, I'm just going to over a cough. The next day, the docket reflected the court canceled my filing, canceled the summons and complaint service, and classified it as a clerical error, and the statement on the docket said that my complaint was deficient. So because of that, we took the Federal Court of Utah, we complained to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, which is what is called a petition for writ of mandamus. If the lower federal court misbehaves, you can go to the 10th Circuit Court above them and complain about that, and then they'll hopefully help you fix the problem with the federal court. Well, they didn't help us, so we took both courts to state court. And while this is happening, my brother, we decided that we should launch another case identical to mine that was getting bogged down, and the goal was to get it to the U.S. Supreme Court. We knew that there wasn't much of a chance of winning in the lower courts, and so at the get-go, we decided we were going to take this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, both cases. So meanwhile, mine is blocked, and so we take the Federal Court of Utah and the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals to state court. We actually sued them in state court and battled there for a while. And we lost, but a few weeks after we lost, the federal court notified us that they had not only allowed me to refile my case, but they actually filed it for me. And they ordered the clerk of the court to issue 388 summonses for the 388 defendants, the sitting president, vice president, 385 members of Congress, and Mike Pence. So meanwhile, as that is still in federal court right now, my brother's case that started in state court that's identical to this case that I just explained, he ended up in federal court. He started in state court, wanted to start there, so the U.S. attorneys moved it to federal court. And then went to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals on appeal because we lost in the federal court. And so it sat there for about 4 months, not moving. And we were pretty frustrated because we wanted them to make a decision, dismiss. We knew that they would, so that we could take it to the U.S. Supreme Court with a petition for writ of certiorari. And so they weren't doing anything. There are three judges in the federal court, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, that make a decision. They were doing nothing. So we got a little frustrated, and we decided to dig deeper. And my legalese brother that knows procedure really well, is not an attorney, he dug in, and he found that there was a United States Supreme Court Rule 11 that allowed you to petition, send a petition for writ of certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court on the grounds, without getting the decision from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, on the grounds that it's a national emergency. So in other words, we were able to file as though we had gotten a decision from the 10th Circuit, even though we had not, hoping that the U.S. Supreme Court would allow us to bypass the 10th Circuit by identifying it as a national emergency. So we had to put right on the face of our petition, perfect bound petition, that it was a Rule 11 petition. The last time a Rule 11 petition was even docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court was in the 70s by the U.S. government, having something to do with the Nixon administration. So we're hoping that when we send this off, we're hoping that we'll hear back from the court that they will docket it as a Rule 11 national emergency case, since we had not received a decision from the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Right. Okay.
So 5 days after we sent it off to them, overnighted it, we received a phone call from the clerk's office. Now, the clerk of the Supreme Court is Scott Sessions Harris, and for 11 years, he was the attorney for the Supreme Court. We didn't know that they had an attorney. And so now he's the clerk of the court, and a case analyst calls us on the phone 5 days after we mail it off, telling us that they have accepted it as a Rule 11 petition. In other words, they are allowing us to bypass the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals and to identify this petition as a national emergency petition.
Interesting.
And so they also, after telling us that they were allowing us to do that, they also requested that we insert content that is not required. They asked us to insert the motion to dismiss presented by the U.S. attorneys. We also included the opposition to the motion to dismiss. And then they asked us how soon we could get it to them, like they were in a hurry to get it. Mm-hmm. And we told them we'd get it to them as soon as we could. And so we went ahead, and after getting off the phone, we prepared it, we reformatted it with the information that they asked us to include. Now, it's kind of a lengthy process. We go to the printers with it after we've completely formatted. There's a certified word count. It's really quite a complex process you have to go through to have it, you know, meet their requirements. And so we're about ready to have it perfect bound, because they also request that it's perfect bound like a book. So you go to the printers with it, and then you take it from the printers to the binding company to have it perfect bound. And as we're about to have it perfect bound, we check the docket, and we received a notice that the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals had made a decision. So we're thinking, okay, well, we don't even need to, you know, we don't need the Rule 11 part of this. Maybe we should call the court and ask them if we can just leave it in anyway, since it's really not needed now, if we can just leave it in. So we call the clerk, the clerk's office. Go ahead.
So I'm sorry, I wasn't interrupting. I really didn't say anything. That's okay. You probably heard something. I do have a question, though.
Okay.
I appreciate it. You mentioned that you're suing 380 some odd, so that's a unique number, because that's not all of Congress. So it sounds like you're suing those people who voted a very specific way on January 6th.
That's right. I should have made that clear.
That's okay.
Not about the outcome of the election, or whether there was enough fraud or not to affect the outcome of the election. It was simply suing those people who refused to investigate, based on 120 some odd members of Congress that were witnesses that there needed to be an investigation.
Right.
And they had a mountain of evidence as well. And so we're suing every single member of Congress that voted against the investigation.
Okay.
For national security breach and breaking oath of office.
Okay. Yeah. I was just trying to get some clarity, because
sure,
my folks may be wondering what 380, I think this is 88 or 85, something like that, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right.
Members of the U.S. House and Senate. Yeah.
Yeah,
every
okay.
single one of the members of Congress that voted against a simple investigation, we're suing.
Okay.
And Mike Pence.
Yes.
Who went ahead and certified it without allowing an investigation to happen. And
right.
Biden and Kamala.
Interesting, though, that you're adding Kamala Harris and Biden, because they didn't have a role at that point in time, I don't believe, in the voting.
I think she was. Wasn't there Kamala Harris a U.S. senator?
Was she, or was she unseated? I don't think she was seated as the senator.
I think she was. But they participated by accepting those offices without the investigation. They should have said, no, we're not going to accept these positions until the investigation happens.
Okay, that's fine. It's okay. But it is a national crisis. There's no doubt in my mind. But let me
identify it as that. The Supreme Court identifies it as a national emergency. Yeah.
I agree.
So here the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeal makes a decision. And so now we don't need to bypass the Tenth Circuit, as we have a decision from them. So we call the clerk's office, and the case analyst picks up every time there's communication. It's like a quick, you know, there's no middle person, just a quick answer, and she's right there.
Uh-huh, right.
And we explain to her that the Tenth Circuit has made a decision, and if we could just send it to her with the Rule 11 so we don't have to reform it. She says, no, you don't need it. Take it out. Make sure you put in that extra stuff we've asked for, the motion to dismiss, And how soon? And then again, she says, how soon can you get it to us? My brother said, about 2 weeks. And she says, can you get it to us sooner than 2 weeks? We'd like it sooner than 2 weeks. Can you do that? And so he says, we'll see what we can do. And so he worked with the printers and the binders, and we got it a week early. So we sent it on a Thursday. They received it on a Friday. And Monday they docketed it and showed that they received it on the 24th, showed that it was filed on the 20th, the day we sent it. And then they notified the U.S. attorneys that they had until November 23rd to file an opposition. The only way the U.S. attorneys can fight this for their defendants is one opportunity allowed by law to file an opposition, and they have a deadline of November 23rd. Well, November 23rd rolls around, and they haven't done anything. And so we checked the docket, and at about 1 o'clock on the 23rd, the U.S. attorneys are no longer representing the 388 defendants. Instead, there's a new counsel of record, and that is the United States Solicitor General, Elizabeth Preloader. And she has come on record as the new attorney representing the defendants. And she doesn't ask for an extension because it's just hours away from when the opposition is due if she's going to file an opposition. And instead, she files a waiver, waiving her defendant's right to oppose this petition before it goes to conference. So a few days after that is docketed, she signs the waiver, waiving the right to file an opposition. A few days later, the docket reflects a January 6, 2023 conference date for this case, for this petition to be voted on by the nine justices. Now, conferences where the nine justices get together and they don't have any interference or any outside attendees, they don't have anyone representing either side of either the respondents or
the
petitioner.
Uh-huh.
And they vote. And if we get 4 out of 9, then it moves forward to a hearing.
Right.
And that's where we're at.
Right. In the hearing process, I believe they picked that up, May, June? It's springtime, right?
The hearing, that's a good question. I don't know, but I think it would be at least a month after conference. And, I mentioned a couple of things that make this very unusual for the fact that they let us bypass the Tenth Circuit. Characterizing it as a national emergency makes this super unusual, a super unusual case. And then the fact that they asked us to include documents that were not necessary, and they also sent us the waiver form asking us to send the waiver to the U.S. attorneys. And asked us to ask them to sign a waiver.
Right, right.
So that's for some really unusual.
Oh, there's a lot of things that to oppose and to attack the Biden administration and the process of how he was chosen can be attacked in so many different ways. And so there have been, as you know, lots of cases. And the interesting thing is that for the most part, when these things have come up into the state courts, or I should say the district courts, the courts have typically been using the lack of standing. And so, as you know, I mean, there were all those, what was her name? She became a very famous lawyer after January 6th, because she was going to save the day, and
Susan Powell.
Powell, there you go. And
it's interesting. Standing was never used as a defense with the U.S. attorneys in our cases, and we have two of them going.
Right.
Mine is still alive in federal court.
Right.
Because they reinstated it. So standing was never a defense. As a matter of fact, they admitted wrongdoing, but they claimed immunity.
Yes.
And so.
So, it's kind of interesting how quickly they dismissed all of these other cases, there's another case that I actually I helped advise the We the People Foundation, who also sued Congress, I think it was late February, early March of 2021, for violating the Electoral College Clause and they violated a few different things, but they actually sued all of Congress because.
Well, I think there's another suit that'll be in conference on January 6th as well. So it's interesting. Mm-hmm. A few of these cases made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and and it's interesting to note that the justices that voted in favor of Trump-related, outcome-related cases. There were three that voted in favor of those cases, and that was Alito and Clarence Thomas and Roberts. Okay, and the three that voted against the Trump-related cases were Trump-appointed justices. And so the climate has changed completely since then. Look at Roe versus Wade, where you've got all six now aligned with doing something we thought would never be done.
Right.
And that's reversing Roe versus Wade. So we have a whole different mentality. We have a whole different climate in this country that would suggest that we truly are in a national emergency situation. And the justices have this power where three have been on board for something like this in the past. This is less extreme than what was asked for with the Trump related. This is, you know, this is removing both sides of the aisle members.
Yeah, it's
and so right. So we think that there will have at least a six. We think there might even be a 9-0 vote on this in a hearing.
Interesting. So the Roe v. Wade, so one of the things I told my listeners, because I mentioned that there was just no way that we're ever going to get changes, and I didn't expect it because it really threw me off that the Supreme Court actually ruled and said what they said. And I thought it was a real sleight of hand, and I try to point this out to everybody, that the reasoning that they used for overturning the Roe v. Wade was basically jurisdiction. They have no jurisdiction. This is not something enumerated. They should never have heard that case. And so
sure.
Then they say in that exact same, you know, ruling or overturning of the Roe v. Wade, they say, even though we, you know, this may be similar with many other cases, that's not the case. So don't pursue jurisdiction. Because bottom line, in a court process, before a piece of paper is, you know, issued out to a defendant to say, prepare yourself, you're being dragged to court, the court has an obligation to determine one jurisdiction and standing. Those are the two things that the court has to do before they even issue a summons. And so, I mean, some people don't understand how perfunctory this process is, but 9 times out of 10, since Marshall and the Marbury v. Madison, there have been more and more of, I'll just say, the unconstitutional leaps of the bench to actually pull in any case that they've wanted to pull in, because this gives, aggrandizes their position to have jurisdiction over things that they have no legitimate jurisdiction over. And so I get amazed when we, you know, see these things happening. And so back to this Roe v. Wade overturning, I was completely befuddled. I had no idea that they would actually put that out, because I think if when you read what Clarence Thomas said, you know, how can you gloss over the fact that he said, okay, we're saying that we had no jurisdiction in this, but again, don't confuse that with all these other things. Why? I mean, is that not a bread trail crumb or what?
Well, not only that, if you dig into Rule 11, the Supreme Court Rule 11, this could be considered an act of war. I mean, this is a very serious thing that happened with lack, you know, not investigating. And then everything that has transpired since then because of the president and vice president that we have. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Look at the second clause of the Declaration of Independence. It talks about we the people have the right to altogether abolish a government if it's gone off the rails. And so the Supreme Court justices have the power to do this. I've had conversations. I have a friend that was a former member of the U.S. House, an attorney, and actually served for a chief justice's clerk office. And he's trying to figure out if they have the power or not to remove members of Congress from their offices.
Sure they do.
Of course they do.
It's right there.
Of course they do.
It's in the 14th Amendment.
Of course they do. Well, and it's up to them to decide what is constitutional, what isn't. And so, yeah, and so he's agreed that they do have that power. And you could just take a simple, let's say it was a capital offense that they had committed, one of them had committed in a state. And the U.S. attorneys appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upholds the capital punishment conviction. Well, that's a removal of office, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but that would be a criminal.
Think, yeah.
That would be a felony criminal,
sure.
Right? So
absolutely. And under Rule 11, the court has the full the full legal authority, the full constitutional power mm-hmm. to adjudicate the complaint, not right. just overturn or uphold a lower court's decision, but actually get into the complaint, which they had done. That's why they were asking us to give to insert into the petition the motion to dismiss, because they had already gone into the docket and researched the case that the petition was about, which is a lot thicker than the petition, which is a pretty thin document, although they with their request, they made it about four times thicker than it was going to be. So they have a tremendous amount of power right now to do the right thing. And also, there have probably been 50 to 60,000 letters at least could have gone to the Supreme Court. We know that because people are sending us copies of the letters they're sending to the court. That's about what we've received. And this is before a case moves out of conference, this kind of public support.
Right.
So we're very hopeful. And worst case scenario is if they don't get the vote they needed to move it forward, we'll file a motion for reconsideration and we'll get more support from we the people in this country. And then we also have an identical case that's in federal court that was, you know, that was canceled and then reinstated, and that has not been dismissed.
Well,
we're not finished with this.
Here's an interesting thing, because I pray that you guys win and unseat Biden, just to be clear. But
that's a good prayer.
But we've come to a point as a nation where we've accepted government overreach in so many ways that we don't recognize what is constitutional and what isn't constitutional anymore. And I'll give you a good case in point, because this your case is kind of based on this constitutional oversight or the fact that Congress has a responsibility to investigate. But as the Constitution was ratified and as it was sold to the states at the time, it was clear, because in all of the contested ratification debates, the Constitution was clarified that the jurisdiction was limited to the enumerated powers. So, you know, they couldn't create a treaty that they didn't have the enumerated powers to create, or they couldn't, you know, the court couldn't hear a case that wasn't within their enumerated powers. I mean, John Marshall in Virginia actually stated that during the ratification debates, that if Congress created a law or, you know, basically tried to enforce a law that wasn't within their enumerated powers, the courts would basically say it's not within our jurisdiction and it would be considered void. The law would be considered void. And so when we come down to elections, I'm not aware of anything other than the fact that U.S. citizens has been a part of the Constitution in four separate amendments, where the Congress has basically established that this is a citizen's right, that regardless of color, regardless of, you know, money, because of the poll taxes. So the four amendments was obviously the slaves or blacks being able to vote, and then removing poll tax, then women, and then 18-year-olds. But the requirement is always stated that only U.S. citizens. Now, in the case of investigating whether non-citizens, now I think that's something that Congress would have that within their enumerated powers, because it's within those four amendments, because elections really weren't under federal control prior to these amendments. And the, you know, other than some very perfunctory things regarding the time and date and those things, other than the Electoral College. The Electoral College is very, very specific, and it's so specific that they even had to create a 12th Amendment when they made a minor modification to it. And so it's one thing if it's under the Electoral College that they should have this huge investigative right, if that's what's driving the investigation, or U.S. citizenship. And so I find it interesting that the case itself hinges on this investigation. And I'm going, well, you know, everybody accepts the fact that Congress can investigate whether steroid use is in professional sports and all these other things. I'm going, well, this isn't a reach. But as a constitutionalist and understanding the Constitution, you know, I'm the one that's always saying they don't have jurisdiction over these things. But I'm like the one on the, I guess, on the outside or deep in the wilderness, because people haven't gotten that far yet to really start understanding and challenging what the federal government has been really delegated in this Constitution, because we're so illiterate as a nation regarding the Constitution. Yeah. And so,
well, I tell people, see, I've written some books about the Constitution, and I have a pocket-sized book that has Q&A in the back, and it has discoveries that I claim have never been published before, identifying clauses in the Constitution that are really powerful, but they've been ignored, misunderstood, misused. And so I tell people, I say, look for low-hanging fruit when you're reading the Constitution. Go through it. Don't get bogged down. Find stuff that you connect with. And I think this case uncovers a great example of low-hanging fruit, and that is Article 6 of the Constitution requires a binding oath.
Yep.
And so, and that's one of the challenges. That's part of the complaint, is we're claiming that their only defense, it's not standing, it's jurisdiction, it's immunity mostly. And so how can Article 6 be so clear and state that they shall be bound by oath to this Constitution, and then we can find statutes, federal and state laws, that have been passed by these same members of Congress, you know, or earlier ones, giving themselves immunity.
Right.
You know, like a California statute that excludes politicians from perjury claims and charges if it's the oath of office and they're politicians. So they can commit perjury when it has to do with the oath of office, which connects to a serious national security breach, right?
Nope.
If you're going to have people take an oath and lie while they're taking it, not defend the Constitution. That's what started my studies, is Obama, Barack Obama, telling the world that the Constitution is fundamentally flawed. It's like having a defense attorney and standing up in front of the judge and the jury saying, my client's fundamentally flawed. It's like, well, you should be fired, you should be disbarred, you shouldn't be representing your client. Right.
Yeah. So
this uncovers a huge but clear understanding of one flagrant violation of the Constitution. That's a binding oath and then giving themselves immunity. And if we had hired a law firm to do what we're doing, we would have ended up in a claims court. At the best case scenario, we would have ended up in a claims court, a dead end.
Right. Well,
because you have to get permission, a waiver, and you can't file in federal court with a law firm.
Right.
They'll send you into a claims court.
So they can't grant themselves, to be clear, because this is actually coming up with even law enforcement having immunity from bad behavior by denying people of their civil rights. Doesn't matter if you're a politician. It doesn't matter if you're law enforcement. You cannot have immunity when it comes to the rights of the people, because the Constitution is clear that this right shall not be abridged. It shall not be infringed. And so unless there is some amendment that it says, that we can actually create our own immunity to violate these things, then they don't. Because even the 14th Amendment states that no state can make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen.
Well, sure. And then there are due process clauses, too. You know, isn't it interesting?
Yes.
I'm not going to say who it was, but in the Senate hearing, one of the justices was asked what the five protections in the First Amendment were. And this particular person, here had been a judge and was going to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice, couldn't remember the most important one. And it's symbolic that that person couldn't remember, because it's the one that has not been used. It's the one that the protection that we haven't been able to experience because of immunity. It's a petition for redress of grievance.
Right, the right of petition for redress.
And so we haven't been able to do that. And so this case opens up a whole new opportunity for law firms and people to bring civil cases, civil action against their representatives that have been violating their oath and violating their constituents.
Right, so it's interesting, because Bob Schultz of the We the People Foundation, that is his driving premise, the right of petition and for the redress of grievances, the history of that and all of that. And I'm writing an article regarding that. And the reason why, looking at it objectively, at least I'm going to give you a reason why I think our society has completely ignored that one right, is due to the fact that they don't understand the divinity of the right. They don't understand that this actually came from God, because most people understand their own freedoms, but they don't understand that God commanded out of the Garden of Eden, he commanded man to petition him. Ask and ye shall receive.
Right.
And, exactly. and this concept of petitioning and holding accountable. I mean, even when we looked at these, I'll just say, you know, all of these different types of petitions that were out there. When it comes to the concept of holding our representatives accountable, that was one of the most amazing things. As a matter of fact, out of the ratification debates, in the Virginia ratification debates, it was James Monroe, who was an anti-federalist. The one thing that actually turned him warm and actually started embracing the Constitution and voting, ultimately voting for the ratification of the Constitution, was the oath of office. He says, no other nation does this. This is a legal binding, you know, process that holds people accountable. The one problem that they had, and this is, I think, when Madison made comments that this thing wasn't perfect because it relied on the integrity and the honesty of a man. And so they didn't have some legally binding tooth in the Constitution until the 14th Amendment. And I try to help people understand that that 14th Amendment, those radical Republicans, I believe were assembled by the divine hand of providence to give us that Section 3 and all of these other parts of the 14th Amendment. Because if you look at what each part does, it actually solves the problems that have been obscured over the 14th Amendment, like the citizenship and anchor babies. The 14th Amendment does not grant anchor babies the right of a citizen. And so forth, and so I could go on and on. But you're right. The right of petition is huge.
And there have been a lot of different oaths that have had real sharp teeth in them, you know.
Right.
And the military oath, the congressional oath, the military oath is the best one.
Or the oath of the citizen.
For purpose of evasion.
Right. So here's a good case in point that I try to teach people, that every state in this union has a tooth regarding the oath of the citizen. In other words, the state can actually call any 17-year-old up to serve and ultimately die, put their life in supporting the Constitution and defending it against enemies, foreign and domestic. Those laws exist in all states today. That the militias are a essential part of our national security, that the states can actually do this. The fact that the National Guard was done unconstitutionally and it's problematic, it's a violation, is a different story. But the fact is that we as citizens and our birthright as a citizen, along with that comes that oath. It is implied with that birthright that the government does have this level of sovereignty to say you must support and defend this Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. And we don't even think about that. We don't teach our kids this in school. This is why we're such a snot-nosed, you know, I'll just say, an entitlement society. Gimme, 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 instead of actually being held accountable.
Jefferson, what did Jefferson say? He said the true corrective for constitutional abuse is what?
Go ahead.
Education.
Oh, there you go.
It's about education.
Sure.
And you got the militia clause, you have the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. But if you go to Article 1, Section 8, and find the word militia and get into that, you'll see that the government, the Congress, has the power to fund us in constitutional education for the enforcing of the laws of the Union, which is the Constitution.
That is correct.
And so Article 1, Section 8 gives the Congress the power to educate us and discipline us,
well,
and train us.
Actually, that's a responsibility.
Yeah.
That's that right there in Article 1, Section 8, I think it's subsection 15, that Congress shall have the power to train, equip, and set standards.
Sure.
And absolutely, they are responsible for this, and the states are responsible.
Right.
Why aren't they teaching firearm safety and, you know, firearms
exactly.
practice and those
and
types of things?
And connected to the Constitution.
That is
absolutely.
Right. That
yeah,
is right.
There's our problem. It's lack of education. Jefferson is correct. We weren't educated. You know, the Bible was published by the Congress, right? And that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but we should have done a lot more. And the money – I tell people, if you don't understand what a privately owned central bank is, you cannot understand the Constitution. You can't get it.
Right.
And so that's my focus with my 2023 edition of the Constitution.
And it's interesting that the very first violation of the Constitution was the Assumption Act, which gave Hamilton the leverage to create a national bank.
Yeah, well, I tell people that the government should not be in the banking business.
Nope, they shouldn't.
And the private sector should not be in the money creation business. And we've combined them, and Hamilton was combining it. He was creating some kind of a weird thing. And so I've talked to Stephen Moore about this, and just to simplify it, I tell people if you could enforce the nonprofit status of the Federal Reserve System and return all of the assets that they have embezzled, basically, from the Treasury, that would eliminate the need for any taxation right down to the local level.
Well, so everything that they've done is fraudulent. And I know you don't understand.
It's amazing. It's amazing there's so much fraud. And it's amazing we're as successful and productive as we are right now with the fraud that's going on.
Right.
But if we were to... Well, and that's why I say this. This case is like it's the Achilles heel. The oath, I think, is the Achilles heel. Once people see that they've given themselves immunity and they start looking at the Constitution, we can really, you know, clean up, I think. So we're very hopeful. And this is, at least it's helping people connect to the Constitution more than they ever have before. They're seeing that, just for them to see that they've given themselves immunity over the years, and they can with a binding oath. I mean, that's a great starting point for people to get into the Constitution and to study it.
Correct. So actually, I have I don't know if you were, you probably were familiar with John Rowland and the Constitution Society. And on the Constitution Society's website back in the 90s, he had a color-coded constitution, and he kind of maintained that to highlight what parts of the Constitution were being violated and what degree of violations there were. One of the things he didn't include was what amendments of the Constitution actually violated other parts, like the 16th Amendment and or the 17th Amendment, how some of these progressive amendments actually ignored certain parts of the Constitution actually violated that because the 17th violates the Article 5. So
yeah, well, I'm kind of taking from my book. Uh-huh. I claim that the Ninth Amendment is one of my discoveries in that it's the interpretation clause. And I tell people, I say, ask any representative to show you a clause in the Constitution that specifically identifies and prohibits socialism. And then I tell them, I say the first 10 amendments were defined by Congress as further declaratory and restrictive clauses to the seven articles. And the last line of the Fifth Amendment states, nor shall private property, which includes your money, be taken for public use without just compensation.
Right.
And so there is a definition of socialism. But the problem with that, and it's not a problem because I solved that in my book, is that's also the definition of taxation. So I tell people that the last line of the Fifth Amendment, it being a further declaratory and restrictive clause, nullifies all the tax clauses within the seven articles. And so how are we going to fund government? And so my book answers that question.
Yes.
Article 1, Section 8 gives the Congress the power to create money, but we've given that power away to a bunch of bandits, crooks.
Mm-hmm.
And talking to Stephen Moore about this, if we could simply, to oversimplify it, enforce the nonprofit status of the Federal Reserve System, every $1 trillion created out of thin air would be profit for the Treasury and not tax debt for the citizen.
Yes,
so we're a bit off course. We're a few degrees off course, and even our most constitutionally conservative representatives don't understand this, the money thing, like I was talking with Stephen Moore about. Mike Lee agreed to meet with me and Congressman Alan Grayson. Congressman Alan Grayson, several years ago, uh-huh. was a member of U.S. House in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know who that is.
Yep.
Two of the most extreme, people on Capitol Hill agreed to meet with me about the Federal Reserve because I had seen Congressman Grayson talking, interviewing or in the congressional hearings having to, the Federal Reserve and money, Bernanke and others, where's the $9 trillion?
Right.
And I think it was Bernanke or someone was explaining not to worry about it, that it was not part of the tax debt and that it went to foreign entities, and Congressman Grayson couldn't get them to identify who the recipients were, the $9 trillion. And what authority did you use to create this money? And they said the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, and then again, it's not reflected in tax debt. You're not going to be, you're not going to be billed for it through taxation. But who got the money? And they said, we can't reveal the identities of the recipients. And it's like, good grief. Now there's a national security breach right there. And so in my book, it talks about money, and we need to understand what the Federal Reserve System is. And we need to understand that when $1 trillion is created out of thin air, it's profit for someone. Mm-hmm. Why is it debt for us?
Right.
And so we are really upside down, but this is kind of basic stuff that people can grasp, and we've got a big problem. We've got a gusher. We've got to shut the gusher off.
Yep.
I say people go into Washington, D.C. with mops. We got to shut the valve off.
So
stop the water.
I agree. My approach is the enumerations. If it's not listed, if it's not enumerated, they can't do it. In other words,
exactly.
if they're spending a penny on something they have no authority to spend, they're creating fraud. Oh, sure. In other words, if they take...
Well, that's a good point to make. That's an excellent point. I tell people, I say, ask your representatives what their understanding is. And they'll probably tell you that if it's not restricted, they can go ahead and do it. I've experimented with local representatives where they say that. Let's enforce the oath of office. And let's hold these people civilly accountable. And that's what this case is about. We're asking for for damages.
Right.
This is a civil lawsuit.
Fortunately, our Constitution wasn't written with restrictions. The Bill of Rights was just further declaratory restrictions. It was sold and ratified on the concept that it was a limited and defined, just like a power of attorney. As a matter of fact, Madison and James Iredell both referred to the Constitutions as a power of attorney, but not a general power of attorney, a specified power of attorney that was very limited with very enumerated powers, roles, responsibilities, and even property. If the property isn't listed, then they can't possess it for these reasons.
Exactly.
That's right. And so it's a contract. It falls actually.
And I hate the term Bill of Rights. I hate that. I think it's just so misleading.
Well,
I like the first declaratory and restrictive clauses.
Yes. But unfortunately, it became what people understood as the Constitution, and it perverted everybody to think that all we had to do was have restrictions. No. No, we have a perfect document that only enumerated these limited powers.
That everyone has been off course because they didn't understand banking's creating money.
Yes.
And they didn't, like Hamilton. I don't think Hamilton really understood it. He's going to create a bank money creation, quasi-bank money creation, government, non-government entity. It's like, what a mess. And people don't understand. And people, you know what? I called the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing quite a few years ago, doing a documentary, and someone answered the phone. I was shocked. And I said, when a $100 bill is created, what do you do with it? Who gets it? And the person says, well, we have one exclusive customer that buys all of the paper money that we print. And I said, who's that? And they said, the Federal Reserve System. And I says, well, what do they pay for it? She says, they pay the cost of the printing. And it's like, okay, great. That's pretty interesting. So I was face-to-face with Congressman Alan West several years ago in Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And I said, when the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing prints a $100 bill, the cost is about 15 cents. Who gets the $99.85 profit?
Mm-hmm.
Whose profit is it? Who gets that? And he looked straight in my eyes and he said, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, this is basic, simple stuff that people can understand
on an
eighth grade level. If it's shown to them, if they're taught it, but we have so much lying and propaganda and confusion going on about money and economics, we're all so confused. And so we have to get to the bottom of that and understand that when a $100 bill is printed, that's a big amount of profit, and the profit belongs to the Treasury, not central bankers. And when $1 trillion is created out of thin air, it's not profit for the central bankers.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what it's supposed to be. That's embezzlement. It's supposed to be profit for the Treasury.
Right.
So if we could enforce the nonprofit status of the Federal Reserve System, it would wipe out entirely 100% the need for any taxation right down to the local level. The Constitution is so brilliant, it is a tax-free system. If we're righteous enough, if we're honest enough, and we're smart enough to handle it properly.
Well, so actually, it's not necessarily a tax-free system, but a personal income tax-free system. You're probably right.
No, it's a tax-free system. It's right down to sales tax. When $1 trillion is created out of thin air, that's supposed to be $1 trillion.
Well,
profit for the Treasury.
So the Constitution, one of the biggest issues was the fact that it had to have taxes, and it had to lay direct taxes.
The Fifth Amendment nullifies all the tax clauses in the Seven Articles. That last line of the Fifth Amendment nullifies all the tax clauses within the Seven Articles. And Article 1, Section 8, the power to create money, eliminates the need for taxation.
So what?
And like I said, if we simply enforce the nonprofit status of the Federal Reserve,
hold on,
we would not need even sales tax on Twinkies.
Hold on. So I believe
you can get my book and you can read it.
I believe so. Actually, I have the debates on the Bill of Rights. I have the debates, and I didn't see Madison say that this Bill of Rights. The actually the seventh article of the Bill of Rights, because that's what it was. It wasn't the Fifth Amendment. It was the Seventh. And he didn't say anywhere where this is going to alleviate, where the government cannot tax.
Well, you had Jefferson saying that if the borrowing clause is inserted in the Constitution, it will destroy this country, right? And who was it? Was it who was it that said the opposite? Said if a national debt is a national blessing.
All of these men read Adam Smith, and Adam Smith basically
stated.
Sure,
and they were opposed to each other, and they said if you got your way, it would destroy the country. They were opposed. But that's what I think is so brilliant about the Constitution. If we really read it with an open mind without going into the history of it, we'll see it's a match. It's a chess match. It's like a game of chess.
I don't disagree.
It's unbelievable. It's incredible.
But the thought of zero taxation, that the government can operate without any funding at all, is unfathomable for me.
No, you're not getting what I'm saying.
Okay.
You really should take a look at my books. Go to 7discoveries.com and download it, or I could send you a free copy. I printed 10,000 of them out, but I'm getting another 11,000 printed. And if you just start from scratch without thinking about the history of economics and money, and realize that when $1 trillion is created out of thin air by the Federal Reserve System,
I'm not denying
that's supposed to be profit.
I'm not denying
that's profit for the Treasury.
So I'm not denying.
Just start there.
I'm not denying that they can't, you know, create this money. They can't. This is all fraud. As a matter of fact, that entire debt clock.
Who are you talking about?
Federal Reserve and the Treasury cannot create this debt.
Explain that there's a difference. A lot of people don't know the difference between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve system.
Well, I understand that, but it doesn't. They both are working together.
You need to explain to your listeners that there's a big difference. That the Treasury is part of the government. The Federal Reserve system is not.
No,
they need to understand.
I'm pretty sure my audience, because we go through this, because I've actually called out Ron Paul in saying audit the Fed, because the Fed is fraudulent. It is unconstitutional, and auditing it only actually legitimizes it.
Sure is. So my book talks about JFK, United States Note Dollars.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Abraham Lincoln, United States Note Dollars.
Okay.
But it's easy to get lost in the complexities of all of the economic mechanisms that have been put in place, I think mostly to confuse us. And so I like to stay as simple as possible. And so when I say to people, some people get it right off the bat.
Okay.
When $1 trillion is created out of thin air by the Federal Reserve System, that trillion belongs to the Treasury. And the Federal Reserve is embezzling it. They're stealing it.
Right.
And that's pure profit for the Treasury. $1 trillion out of thin air is profit, not debt.
And it's profit for the Treasury. And there's other problems with the Treasury possessing money like that and carrying over money and so forth, because they don't have
the authority
to do that.
The problem is the corrupt members of the Treasury and Congress. That's the problem.
Absolutely. It's all been corrupt.
The problem is our leaders. So what I'm saying is we have an incredible system, but it could never work with the current corruption that we have.
The problem I have right now is I don't have any more time, but I would take your book if you don't mind emailing it to me. But we'll
I'll send you it as soon as I get some.
If you can hang on after I close out here, we'll talk. We'll do a wrap up. That way I can go to break. Yeah, we did. That's okay. I love this. That's okay. I will deal with that. Well, I'll get this interview out. But folks, we've really ran out of time, as you can tell, because you're going to be hearing the end of the show here. So, folks, I will be back. I'm GR Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. And Loy, if I can have you back sometime soon, we'll schedule this.
Yeah, let's do it. Just let me know.
Awesome.
Yeah, shoot me a text or something. Let me know when you want me to come back.
All right, folks, stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.